Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. At that time, if you are listening to the live broadcast, you can be a part of it by calling in. Do you have questions, perplexities, objections related to the Bible or to Christianity itself? Well, feel free to give me a call. We'll talk about that. Maybe you're not a Christian and you just think it's plain foolish to believe in the Bible or to be a Christian, or maybe even evil. There are people like that who believe such things. I'd be very interested in hearing somebody make a case for that. If you'd like to do so, you can call me here. The number is toll-free, 1-800-438-5090. Or maybe you're just a Christian who has questions about your faith. Maybe you've been challenged by people who are not Christians, or maybe by other Christians about some doctrinal matter where they see differently than you do. Or maybe it's me that sees something differently than you do, and you'd like to bring correction or balance because you disagree with something I've said. All of those things are fair game right here on the program. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. If you hear guitar music in the background, that's because I'm at a YWAM base sitting in an office. It's not soundproof, and there are YWAM students outside doing things, including playing the guitar. So from time to time, you may hear some background laughter or talking or other sounds. That's okay, because it's this is a casual program, isn't it? I guess those of you who listen regularly know that we're not really trying to maintain a total high level of professionalism. We're just trying to get the job done, talking to callers, doing our best to answer the questions that come up. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Our lines are all full at the moment. And the only reason I haven't taken a call yet is I'm waiting to see the names of some of these callers. They're coming up shortly. The Narrow Path has twice a day that it airs, but on different radio stations. If the station you're listening to is carrying the program, the afternoon program, which is an hour each weekday. The morning program is from 9:30 to 10 every weekday on a different set of stations, but you can hear both programs from anywhere if you are on the internet. You can go to our website at thenarrowpath.com, and there you can find links to listen to either this program or the morning program each day live or later at thenarrowpath.com. All right, we're going to talk to Daryl from Houston, Texas. And by the way, I said the lines were full. They were, but one line has dropped off, so you can get through now if you try 1-800-438-5090. Daryl, welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear your voice. How you doing?
Well, good afternoon. I'm great. I just have a question. I'm maybe looking for a little bit of advice. I'm a Christian, have been so for many years.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I've encountered over the last decade or so than any other point in my life, I guess in dealing with the academia at universities, I work with retirement plans, believe it or not, for professors and whatnot. And one of the things I hear is that many so-called intelligent people are more and more believing that God is an evil deity, that the God of the Bible is a genocidal, homicidal, infanticidal deity, and that the Jewish religion and then the Christian religion that sprung from it is evil. As Christians, how do we make a case against that that's, of course, scriptural and accurate and not just a faith-based case? Looking for a little bit of advice on how to deal with that and do so in a truthful and an intelligent manner.
Yeah, well, I don't know that we can do so without making a faith-based case because, of course, believers in the God of the Bible believe that he is holy and good and righteous and that whatever he determines, whatever he decrees, is righteous and good. Now, that's a starting point for believers in God, and that's because we believe in his character. We believe that he has manifested himself in Jesus and in other ways, too. He's manifested himself even prior to Jesus in the Exodus and in many other signs and so forth he did, and that he has told us who he is. And he's shown himself to be faithful and merciful, most of all, in Jesus coming to die for us. That's, you know, where his mercy is seen. And the Bible explains in many ways that he's also a very just God. So we either believe that or we don't. Now, we don't wait to believe that after we assess everything he's done and see whether we can give our approval to it, for the simple reason that we are not the final arbiters of what is justice. We do have a sense of justice, that is for sure, but we derived it from him. We got it from him. And one thing that he has going for him that we don't have going for us when it comes to making just judgments is that he knows everything. He knows the hearts of every person. He knows what becomes of every person. He knows all the mitigating circumstances that may affect every person's choices. We don't know any of those things. And so because of that, we can't make perfect judgments like he can. And, we could argue that until he can explain himself to us and he can tell us why it's the right thing to do, what he has done, until then we're not going to accept. But what we're saying is, I trust my opinion about what's just more than I trust God's opinion about what's just. And that's not really very wise. Now, of course, that's a faith-based statement. A person who doesn't believe in God at all is going to say, well, I just don't accept that, and that's their business. I mean, there's always been atheists. There's always been people who have made themselves gods. And the Christian has to, without any apology, without any shame, say, well, we do accept the fact that God is sovereign, the fact that God is just. Now, if we wish to ask, how can these genocides in the Old Testament be squared with any concept of justice that God could possibly see it as a right thing to do? There are approaches we can take that are reasonable, but they're only reasonable from the starting point that we're on God's side in every controversy. See, here's the thing. Whenever God had people wiped out, whether it was the whole population of the earth at the flood, and that was men, women, and children, that was genocidal in the extreme, the whole human population except for 8 people was wiped out, or whether it was Sodom and Gomorrah, where fire and brimstone wiped out every man, woman, and child in those cities, except for the Lot and his 2 daughters who escaped. I mean, those are big-time holocausts, you know. And then, of course, there were the times when God told Israel to go in and exterminate the Canaanites, and then on another occasion to do the same to the Amalekites. Those are the only genocides we really see ordered in the Old Testament, but that's enough. That's enough to be a problem. And so we have to say that when God decided to take people out, that he was not doing something unjust for the simple reason that he has the right to decide when sinners will die. And we're all sinners. And the wages of sin is death. Now, if he wants us to die at infancy or in old age or in middle age, that's entirely his business. He doesn't have to let any of us live. We see that when God has these judgments against civilization or civilizations, that he has a controversy with them. They think one thing is right, and he thinks something else is right. And the question is, whose side are we going to be on? And we can choose. We can be on the side of rebellious humanity, or we can be on the side of the righteous God and say, okay, I think if God has a controversy with these people and believes they've done things worthy of death, I think he's probably right. I'm on his side. Now, I can take the other approach if I want to, in which case I make myself an enemy of God. It says in James chapter 4, it says, whoever makes himself a friend of the world is the enemy of God. And I would say that where God has a controversy with the world because of sin, most people take the side of the world because they're sinners and they're not on God's side. But we, as Christians, are distinguished from most people in that we think God's right. And we think God has good cause. Now, even Christians, of course, are fairly sensitive and cringe at some of the severe judgments that God has done. There's no question about that. I would say, in fact, that, when I see a person brought to justice in our human courts and realize that, you know, he's going to be put to death and he deserves it, you know, he's done crimes worthy of death and he's getting a just punishment, but I still cringe at the thought of, you know, how his mother's going to feel. What about his children? You know, what about other people? It's a sad, sad thing that people die. But the question is it a just thing? And the truth is, if God wiped us all out right now, he'd be just, because we've done enough to warrant that. The soul that sins shall die, and all have sinned. So God really has the right to say, I'm going to take you now, and no matter what age you are, I'm going to take you home now. And you'll either go to your home in heaven or your home in hell, but it's time to go. And if I didn't do it now, I'd do it some other time because everyone's going to die. So
and
the
that's
people,
pretty much the direction that I've leaned. The only issue that I've had or difficulty that I say is the issue of the infanticide, the unborn, the children who aren't guilty of sin.
Yeah, well, the point is, if they aren't guilty, then they're saved, right? I mean, if somebody is not guilty of sin, then when they die, they live forever. The interesting thing is that God always does the thing that is most just and merciful, but it's not always so from our point of view because we have an earthbound point of view. We think the most desirable thing is for a person to live long. I mean, why not? Well, the way I see it, there are some people who, if they died in infancy, they'd go to heaven. But if they lived to adulthood, they'd take an entirely different path and they'd go to hell when they die. They're going to die anyway. The question is God sparing them by taking them early? Sparing them an eternal fate that would be more horrible if they had grown up? And by the way, if I died at age 5 or at age 105, in eternity it wouldn't make any matter to me. What would matter is where I am in eternity. You know, where I spent that 100 years, which would be like 0 years compared to eternity, would be no concern of mine. I wouldn't care that I died at age 5 or age 105, unless dying at age 5 I would have gone to heaven, and age 105 I would have gone to hell. That'd make a difference. And the Canaanite people were, you know, they were killing their own children. They were sacrificing their children to their gods. These children were not getting a really good deal by being in these Canaanite families, and their parents were all set for extermination. Frankly, it's hard to imagine killing a child, but again, if you take God's point of view, he's not happy about the death of children, but they're all going to die one way or another, and if he says, okay, it's going to be more merciful to take them this way than to let them live and take them in old age, I'm going to be with God on this. God knows more than I do. Now, the unbeliever who just says, well, God doesn't have any good reason for doing what he's doing, frankly, that unbeliever doesn't know half as much as he thinks he does. And one thing he's certainly not even taking into consideration is eternity. Because the same person who's saying these things about God is usually an atheist and doesn't believe there's immortality. So, in other words, they're coming from the point of view that living as long and healthy a life on earth as possible is the ultimate desirable thing. And for God to deprive somebody of that, somehow, he's got to give a good reason for that. But they're not considering. Jesus said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? If your soul is saved, if you spend eternity with Christ, then you're well off no matter what happened to you in your life. Remember Jesus said, he that seeks to save his life will lose it. He that will lose his life for my sake shall find it. So if a child dies in infancy, and in my opinion, you're right, they are innocent. Because they are innocent, they are not lost. But if they had grown up and died as adults, they might have been lost. Many people have been, who would have been somewhat better off dying in infancy, frankly. I mean, it sounds callous to our secular ears, because we do not believe what God said about eternity. But I do believe in it. I believe in eternity. And therefore, I don't ask, why did God let my wife die in an accident when she was 25 years old? God, how do you explain that? I say, well, thank God she was prepared to die. And better that she died at 25, ready to be with the Lord, than that somebody else dies at 125 and they go to hell. I mean, frankly, the Bible teaches us to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And one of the things that changes in our minds when we become believers is we take into account eternal matters. And that puts a whole different cast on the question of eternity and justice. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, in that spiritual perspective, I guess it comes back to what I said to some people. But again, I guess this spiritual things are spiritually discerned, and those who don't have that mindset may not ever discern. I guess that's what's hard to accept, that some people you never are going to get the message across to, because the means by which we as Christians have may not be effective to those who don't believe.
Well, you're right. The natural man cannot receive the things of the Spirit of God, which includes considerations that take eternity into consideration, because they're foolishness to them. And, even the gospel itself is foolishness to those who are perishing. How much more some of these fine points of what the gospel teaches us their foolishness to people who are perishing. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who will be bringing these objections are people who are they're perishing. I mean, that's why they're bringing the objections. They are perishing people. And you can't really escape the fact that no matter how sensible your view is from the standpoint of God's, you know, worldview that he gives us, they're going to look foolish to people who have a different worldview. And sometimes we're going to have to look like fools for Christ, like Paul said. Even you know, the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. So, sadly, we can't make it look respectable to everybody. We can only really make an appeal to people who decide they want to be on God's side instead of on the side of God's enemies.
Yes.
Once we're on God's side, we can see his point of view a little more clearly.
And that's unfortunate, especially for those who won't see it from a spiritual perspective. But it's a reality. All won't see. The path is narrow. So I guess it's somewhat difficult to deal with that reality.
It is. It's disappointing. It's disappointing that everybody can't be what we would consider to be reasonable. The irony is that they don't think we're being reasonable because they don't see what we're seeing, you know. It's like a blind man and a man with his eyes open will maybe draw different conclusions about the color of the room that they're in. And the blind man who's never seen color at all might think it's foolish for a sighted man to say that the room has a certain color. And the blind man doesn't even know what color is. In fact, he might even deny that it exists. In his realm, it doesn't. But to the man who's got eyes that work, he knows what they don't. And you know what? The blind man might hold a PhD in philosophy or science or something else. And he might convince himself that color is non-existent because he's never seen it. And yet a person who's a peasant without any education at all but has one good eye that works would know more about it than the blind PhD.
And it goes back to you can't win. You win all the battles. I mean, Jesus didn't even win over all the Pharisees. And if he can't win them all, we can't expect to win them all either as Christians.
Yeah, we'd like to. We'd like to, but we just have to be faithful to the truth. And certainly that requires that we're standing on God's side of every controversy, especially his controversy against his enemies.
Definitely. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
Okay, Daryl. God bless you. Bye now. Let's talk to Lori from Portland, Oregon next. Lori, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I originally had a completely different question for you, but this last caller piqued a question in me that I've had for a long time, and it really it seems kind of foolish, a very small matter, but it matters to me. In 1 Samuel, I only know this because I just hurriedly looked it up while I was waiting to talk, but in 1 Samuel, I don't even know whose war it is. I think it's David's. And then also there's another one in Joshua. The leader of the war, I guess David and maybe Joshua and the other one, is instructed when he goes to wipe out, in this war, wipe out the enemy, he's instructed to hoss the horses. And it's like, okay, could you just kill them? I mean, that sounds horrendously cruel. And I know that God does care about his creation because there are places in the Bible, for instance, in Noah, in Jonah, where he mentions, you know, if you don't go and evangelize to Nineveh, then so and so many thousands of people plus animals will die. So he cares. I mean, it's funny that why would he mention the animals if that wasn't a concern? And you know, other things about the ox that treads the grain and different things. So he says things that show a concern for animals, so I never got this part about huffing the horses. What is that about?
Yeah. Well, it was common practice in ancient wars when they defeated their foes to hamstring the horses. That means to cut the hamstring behind their foot so that they were crippled.
Right.
Of course, the horse is no good for anything after that, and you might as well put it down, you know. Of course, the reason they hamstrung the horses was not out of any hostility they felt toward horses, but because the horse was the military vehicle. It was like disabling the armored cars or the tanks of your enemy so they can't use them anymore. I mean, the cavalry was the strongest military force, and the horse was the primary military vehicle. So it's like, you know, blowing up the jeeps and blowing up the tanks of the enemy so that they don't have these military vehicles. Now, one might say, well, why hamstring? Why not just kill the horses?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I have a feeling that we're in the thick of battle, when there's people fighting all around you, it's easier to just take your sword and whack the horse's leg than to actually kill the horse in a way that would for sure put it out of its misery. I mean, you'd have to give some attention to that, and you might be spending more of your attention fighting off the people who are around you trying to kill you. You know, I really don't know.
Yeah.
It may well be that when all the dust had settled and the war was over, that they went and put the horses out of their miseries. But the main thing was to disable the horses in the midst of the battle, so that they would be able to continue fighting the battle without the obstacle of armed cavalry against them. And you could, of course, if you were fighting with a sword, which is how they fought, you could pretty much whack the bottom part of a horse's leg badly enough to put it out of commission. But if you're going to try to kill a big beast like that, you're going to have to hit it in a vital organ. You're going to have to penetrate a lot of flesh. It's going to take a lot more energy and a lot more time. So, I mean, I think just the well-being of animals in general is something that God has a concern for, but not so much as to, spare the horses, some pain. Yeah, in order that and have his people in the midst of the battle endangered by human opponents at the same time. That's my guess.
Yeah, once again, seeing things from a God's eye view. Yeah. So do you have a minute for my other question?
Sure.
Quick one,
go ahead.
Recently I was going to ask you what you think about these church-organized trips to Israel and the reference to Israel, calling Israel the Holy Land.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't believe Israel is a holy land anymore. I mean, it's not. And how could anything be holy that's not dedicated to Jesus Christ? And Israel is not. I mean, the people of Israel are not a holy people unless they're followers of Christ, in which case they're just Christians like us. People who are not followers of Christ and who are anti-Christ can hardly be called holy. And certainly all people of anti-Christian religions are anti-Christ. I mean, John in 1 John said, whoever denies that Jesus is the Christ, that person is anti-Christ. So we sometimes think of the Jews as a holy people and their country as a holy land, and that was true at one time, but not after they decided that they were not going to be following God anymore. And following God requires that you follow His Son. When He sends His prophets, or especially when He sends the Messiah, you don't have the option of saying, well, I'll still follow God but reject His prophet, or I'll follow God and reject His Messiah. Jesus said that's not an option. He said, whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent Him. And so, it's not a holy land anymore. But I think if people refer to it as the Holy Land, meaning the land that was once, the promised land, especially picked out by God for certain activities that He was doing specially, and it was certainly the land that God gave to His people in those days, There's something to be said for it if we're talking about it historically that way.
Well, the point of these tours is usually to, see the Garden of Gethsemane, be where you walked, experience all that. And I wonder if that money couldn't be better given to the poor, although there has to be some merit in getting to experience these things. But if you had to weigh where you're going to spend your money,
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure the money could, in many cases, be better spent, but in some cases, maybe not. It really depends. I mean, certainly helping the poor is a good thing, but also, when Mary poured out that expensive ointment over Jesus' head, that seemed very wasteful, and Judas was the one who complained, said it should have been given to the poor, and Jesus said, no, she's done this to honor me. And it's hard to say. I mean, I personally don't think that God is more honored just by people going to Israel. I do think that some people, when I went to Israel, I didn't have this experience, but many people testify that just being where Jesus was somehow does something, makes Him seem more real to them. Maybe, if it changes their life so that Jesus is more real in their life afterwards, who knows, maybe it's worth that much money and more. I mean, they can still give to the poor, like Jesus said, the poor you have with you always, you can always give to them, but this woman has done this to honor me. It's possible that in many cases people receive a spiritual benefit by just by, you know, psychologically what it does to them to see, you know, the lake where Jesus preached and the place where the Sermon on the Mount was probably preached and the tomb where Jesus may have been buried and so forth. I don't think that Christians should have to make those trips in order to, you know, have a great spiritual life. But I do know that many people have told me it's had that effect on them. I said it didn't have that effect on me because I went there. I didn't go there as a tourist. I went there some years ago as a teacher, teaching in a Bible school right in Jerusalem. And I was there for 2 weeks. And I had always heard all my life, you know, oh, when you go to Israel, your life will be changed. You'll never be the same. It'll make you feel so much closer to God. And I kind of thought maybe that'd be true. I thought it might be kind of neat, you know, to walk a certain place and realize, you know, Jesus, 2,000 years ago, may have stood on this very spot. You know, I mean, I thought that might be cool. But actually, it was a real disappointment when I went. When I went to Jerusalem, it just seemed to me like a religious theme park, you know, just people trying to make money, showing you sites that they claim are holy sites, which were very questionable in every case, or almost every case. And it just seemed like it was a tourist trap and a tourist attraction. I felt less close to Jesus in that environment than I feel when I'm in California. I will say, though, that when I went to Capernaum, I knew Jesus had spent much of his ministry in Capernaum, and that place is still kind of unspoiled. I mean, you can still stand on the lake, and it's probably a lot similar to the way it was when he was there. And I will say that it was kind of meaningful for me to stand there and say, well, you know, Jesus was right here on this lake, and maybe, you know, very possibly at one point or another at this spot. But that should not be at all necessary in order to have a meaningful relationship with Christ. It's just that for some people, seeing it with their own eyes, I think, makes it more real to them. And if Jesus is more real for the rest of your life and it changes the way you live with him, then I'd say it might be worth that much money and more. It's hard to say. But I do think you're right that a lot of people feel there's some kind of spiritual merit simply in going to this land, and maybe even in the money you spend there, because it supports the Israeli economy, and you know, we're blessing Israel that way and so forth. I don't share the views that many have, which are that, you know, any money spent in Israel is money well spent. I personally think that God would be much more interested in seeing the money spent on reaching the lost for Christ than for having a vacation, generally speaking, anywhere. But a vacation in Israel sometimes does have a positive spiritual effect on people. So I'm not going to judge those who do it and say it was well worth it. It could well be. I didn't have a particularly spiritual experience there any more than anywhere else on the planet.
So then how much attention should we give to praying for the peace of Jerusalem?
Well, pray for the peace of Jerusalem is an Old Testament exhortation that's written in the Psalms. And, of course, Jerusalem was the headquarters of the holy, you know, nation, Israel, at that time. And for the peace of the nation, it'd be like saying pray for the peace of Washington, D.C. It means, of course, you know, pray for America to have peace. I don't think there's anything wrong at all with Christians praying for the peace of Jerusalem or the peace of the nation of Israel. But I don't think that the command in the Old Testament has the significance that it today that it had then, because Jerusalem was the holy city back then. It was the capital of God's kingdom on earth. That's not true anymore, of course. We could spiritualize it and say, well, we could pray for the peace of the present, you know, the new Jerusalem, which is the church. But I mean, lots of people, simply their theology does not take into consideration that Jerusalem and Israel do not have the same significance since Jesus has come and since Jesus has died and resurrected as they had in Old Testament times. So people often, you know, think it's a very spiritual thing to go there.
Okay, well, you've more than answered my questions, and I'm sure you've got people waiting, so I'll let you go.
Okay, well, I appreciate your call, Lori.
And I thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, bye-bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Joel, calling from Las Vegas. We also have a line open for you, and we still have some time, almost half the program ahead of us. If you'd like to be on the program, you can probably get in. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. 5090. You can call if you have a question or if you have a disagreement. Welcome to do so here at My Dime, 1-800-438-5090. My name is Steve Gregg. You're listening to The Narrow Path. And Joel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. My question is a brief one. Today I have to take it off the phone because, like I always tell you, I'm driving. But
okay.
I heard you talking to the male caller before the last lady there, and I couldn't help be curious. When you were talking about, you know, eternity and God mercifully taking you early and everything, I was wondering, since I listened to a lot of your previous program and talks, that you said something about, I think you said something about you were studying the views, you know, that there's so many different views of what happens when a person goes out into eternity without the Lord. So I was just wondering if you have decided on a certain view yet, and if you could just tell us what that is, if you have.
You mean when an unbeliever dies?
That's correct.
Yeah.
You know
okay.
what I mean, Steve, like
mm-hmm.
Seventh-day Adventists, they teach
right.
that you will suffer, but then you'll be annihilated after a certain amount of suffering. I was just wondering what your view was on it.
Okay, well, the truth of the matter is I'm not any closer to deciding than I was probably last time I addressed it. I personally am still considering all three views, and
okay.
I consider that the traditional view has the least scriptural support of the three. The other two I can't choose between because they both have a very strong scriptural support in their favor, I think.
All righty. I was just trying to see where you were at that point. Well, thank you very much for the answer.
Okay, Joel. God bless you.
Okay. All right.
By the way, you may remember when I've spoken about this, we're talking about the three views of hell. Many of our listeners don't know there are three views of hell that evangelical Christians hold, but there are. And I've you know, been looking into the biblical case for each of these views for many years, actually for 20 years, 25 years maybe. I've been looking at this and weighing the scriptural evidence. And it is difficult to choose one over the others once you consider all the pros and cons for each view. And my tentative conclusion is I probably will not decide. I probably will not be able to have enough information to decide which view is correct with certainty. I can, you know, when I'm reading the arguments for one of the views, I can see its merits. But when I read the evidence for another of the views, I say, well, it's got biblical merit too. And I guess I'm very relaxed about the matter. I don't think that I have to know. My knowing it or not knowing it isn't going to change it. The truth of the matter is, when people die unprepared to meet God, they're going to face hell, whatever that is, whatever it's like. My curiosity about it is entirely unrelated to the reality itself. If it could be far worse than I imagine, or not as bad as I think, but it is what it is. And my having an opinion about it isn't going to be worth the hill of beans, as near as I can tell. The point I was making, of course, about the children who were slaughtered in the genocides in the Old Testament is that in my belief, not everyone shares this belief, but I believe that infants who die are truly innocent, and that because they are innocent, they do not go to hell. I believe that they do go to be with the Lord. Jesus said this about infants. He said, do not forbid them to come unto me, because of such is the kingdom of God. So Jesus said that the kingdom of God is made up of such as them, infants. And when innocent people die, it's always sad for the survivors. Of course, these infants had no survivors because their parents were killed too. But the saddest thing about someone dying, two things are sad about them. One is that their survivors grieve over their loss. And the other is the question of whether these people who died are in a better place or a worse place after they've died. If they're in a better place and there's no one to grieve them, then there's nothing really tragic about the situation any more than if they'd lived to a ripe old age and came to the same end, because people do. Everyone dies. And in Isaiah 57:1, the prophet says, the righteous perishes, and no one takes it to heart. Merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from the evil. That is, when people when righteous people die, they leave this evil realm, and they go to something better. And that's a distinctive Christian worldview, and maybe, I suppose, some other religions might hold it too. But it is a worldview that people like atheists, who don't share any view of immortality or a life after this one, well, they simply can't appreciate that argument. It just sounds foolish to them. Let's talk to Jose from North Las Vegas. Jose, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you. I got a question. On Judges chapter 1?
Yes.
It says that the Kenites, the father-in-law of Moses, the Kenites, he talks about a Kenite that he took over the... He's staying in the wilderness of Judah to live with Israel. And this Kenite, would that be the Jethro or the father of the Ethiopian woman?
I believe that that would be Jethro. And Jethro was, of course, a priest of Midian. And so the Kenites, I believe, would have to be seen as a sub-clan within the race of the Midianites. Because Moses' brother-in-law, which I assume is the brother of his wife, and she was a Midianite, he is said to be a Kenite. So it is my understanding, and I don't know all of the ways that the racial issues interwove with each other in those days, but my understanding would be the Kenite would be a sub-clan within the Midianites, so that a man might be called a Kenite and a Midianite. It's the same way, for example, when Midianites are known as Ishmaelites the book. Yeah, in the story of Joseph being sold into slavery, half the time it says the Ishmaelites sold him to Potiphar, and the other time it says the Midianites did. Likewise, in the story of Gideon, in Judges chapter 8, it says that he delivered Israel from the Midianites. And these Midianites had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites, it says. So it's obvious that some of these racial groups divided into smaller subcategories and could be known different ways. Sort of like I'm a Californian and an American. And someone might refer to me as an American on one hand and refer to me as a Californian at some other time. And as a Santa Cruzan on another occasion. And they'd all be right. But someone who didn't know anything about the relationship between California and the United States and Santa Cruz would they're just hearing things that would confuse them and say, what, is this a contradiction? But it's really not, as we know.
Okay. Also, on the same chapter, it talks about Judah destroying Jerusalem. And then later on, it says that Benjamin didn't... It talks about Judah taking over Jerusalem, and then later on says that Benjamin didn't destroy all the Jebusites. So I was always under the impression that Jerusalem belonged to Judah, but I read that it actually belonged to Benjamin.
Well, Benjamin and Judah shared Jerusalem. Part of Jerusalem was in the territory of Benjamin. And part of it was in the territory of Judah, in the later division of the land. So it was shared by both tribes. But it was the capital of the nation of Judah, which included Judah and Benjamin after the nation divided into two. So it's both. Both Judah and Benjamin had claims on Jerusalem.
Do you got time for one more quick question?
Very quickly, because I have to take some more calls. Okay. Go ahead.
Melchizedek, I'm almost 100% sure that he was the king of Jerusalem. What do you think?
Well, Melchizedek is said to be the king of Salem in Genesis chapter 14. And Salem in the Bible is sometimes used as a short form of Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
And Salem really is a form of the Hebrew word shalom.
Uh-huh.
And the city of Jerusalem, Yerushalom, means the city of peace. Shalom means peace.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes in the Bible it's called Jerusalem, and on rare, very rare occasions, once or twice as far as I know, It's sometimes simply called Salem, referring to the same city. Now, Melchizedek is said to be the king of Salem. So many scholars believe that he was the king of the city of Jerusalem in the days of Abraham. However, the writer of Hebrews talks about this in Hebrews chapter 7 and says that when the Bible tells us Melchizedek was the king of Salem, the writer of Hebrews says that means he was the king of peace. In other words, he's saying we're not talking about the city called Salem, but that the scripture really means he's the king of peace. And his name, Melchizedek, the actual meaning of the word Melchizedek is the king of righteousness. So the writer of Hebrews is bringing these points out to point out that Melchizedek was somebody more than meets the eye. He's more than just an earthly king. He's the king of righteousness. He's the king of peace. And he goes on to say that the man had no beginning of days or end of life and had no father or mother and remains a priest continually. So my impression is Melchizedek was actually what we call a theophany, an appearance of Christ.
Okay, because I just read in Joshua about an Adonisedek, king of the Jebusites. And he was a king in Jerusalem. And the name kind of sounds like Melchizedek, Adonisedek, like it belongs to the same kind of people.
That's because the word Zedek means king.
Zedek?
Yeah, Zedek means king. And so Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Adonisedek means the Lord is my king. But the Zedek part of the name is actually the Hebrew word for king, or for the Middle Eastern term for that.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. God bless you, and I'll talk to you later.
All right. Good talking to you, Jose. Keep studying. You're doing a good job.
Thank you, sir.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.
You know, Jose calls quite a bit, and he's obviously reading through the Old Testament, and he's very observant. It's good to, you know, when you read through the Old Testament, it's good to be, you have your brain turned on it, as he clearly does, because he's noticing things and comparing things. And I appreciate somebody who's an observant student of the Scriptures. We don't have enough of them around anymore, and I'd love to encourage all of you to be that way. Let's talk to Jim Fink, my friend from Monterey, long time since I've heard from Jim Fink. How you doing, brother? You still alive, huh?
Yes.
Good.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you used to be calling all the time, and I haven't heard you. Have you been in the hospital again?
No, it's just I've been very, very busy working, actually trying to start a new company.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting to me, but we don't have enough time to go into that, so we'll go to your question first,
yeah.
And we can talk about that some other time.
My questions are actually twofold.
Mm-hmm.
One is, if an adult sees fit to adopt a mature adolescent as a godchild, does that have to be a bilateral thing, or can the adult unilaterally make that decision that this person will hereafter be my godchild?
You mean, does that have to be agreed to by the godchild?
Exactly, that's the question.
Well, that's a really good question, and it certainly is not one that I can answer, because I am not familiar with the customs of being godfather and godchild. That's kind of a Roman Catholic custom that I've never had much knowledge about. I've met people who say that such and such a person is their godfather or their godchild, and I've always wondered. I wonder what that means. But it's not really a biblical custom. And I mean, there's no one in the Bible that has a godfather or a godchild. That's a custom that came up later. And so I think, as far as the rules concerning that, you'd probably have to ask a Roman Catholic priest or someone like that who would know more than I would about that particular custom. I would think it's strange if the godchild candidate, was a mature adolescent. It'd be strange for someone to adopt them without that person's approval, since they are a young adult already. But I don't know what the rules are about godchilds.
Okay. Let me explain further for the people that have picture idea of what a godfather is. That isn't it at all.
Yeah, we're not talking about the mafia. Hey, Jim, we don't want to explain too much because I've got my lines full and I only have about 7 minutes left. So did you have a second question?
Yes, second question. On discipleship, does the... If a person thinks that somebody else needs to be discipled, a la Paul and Timothy, does the person in the Timothy role have to concur beforehand?
I would think so, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't believe that a Christian leader can impose his leadership on an unwilling other party, unless that other party is his own child. You know, I mean, a father or a mother certainly can impose their authority on their minor children. But if we're talking about a young man or a young woman who needs to be discipled, I don't think you can easily disciple them without them agreeing that they need to be discipled and agreeing that you're the one they want to see do it. Otherwise, it's kind of a tyranny, a spiritual tyranny, and almost could be seen as a spiritual abuse.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I think the person's free will would
go there. But I'm actually facing that pair of questions from somebody that I am extremely close to. And since you've identified me by name, some of the listeners may put two and two together and know exactly who I'm talking about. But I've run into that. And things were different when this person was a teenager. Now he's turning 25, and all of a sudden he's decided he doesn't want the arrangement anymore.
Well, I would think that a 25-year-old's choice should be honored about that. But again, I don't know what the Catholic customs are about that. You know, if you've been the person's godfather from his childhood, and now he's getting to the age he doesn't feel like he needs a godfather, is that the idea?
Something like that, yes.
Yeah, well, I think you need to talk to possibly a Catholic authority to give you the fine points of that, because I'm not really knowledgeable. All right?
Because, you know, I don't want to do the wrong thing.
Right, I understand that, Jim, and I don't either. And I think it would be the wrong thing for me to just ramble on about this while this call is ready, but I do think that you can probably find someone who knows more about it than I do, and therefore it wouldn't make an awful lot of sense for me to speculate about it. We have some more calls I'd like to take, and not very many minutes left. Jim, thanks for your call. We're going to talk to Bob from Halsey in Oregon. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. I'm with you on your understanding of hell, the three views. And I appreciate those views. I think I kind of nailed down where I've always believed and appreciate the fact that you brought up the scriptures that made me see it clearly. The question I have now, though, is the man of sin... I also agree with you that that's probably discussing the papacy, or at least that's what I've heard you say. Is that in any way the beast or the false prophet revelation that's thrown into the lake of fire?
Well, the reformers thought so. I'm not necessarily of that opinion, but all of the writers and thinkers of the Reformation believed that the papacy could be seen in the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians 2, and also in the beast and the false prophet in Revelation 13 and following. So, the papacy was seen as the ultimate bad person by the reformers in all of these passages. I myself am more nuanced in my view. I believe that the argument for the papacy being the man of sin or the man of lawlessness is a pretty strong argument. I think it's very possibly correct, maybe probably correct. As far as the beast in the new in the book of Revelation, I'm inclined to see the beast differently than that. I personally think that the beast in Revelation represents every governmental system ever, at all times in any place that persecute the Christians, and the second beast represents every religious system that does the same thing. And of course, that will surprise a lot of listeners who haven't heard the different views of Revelation. But my own view. Has come out of consideration of all the views that are available and all the arguments for them, and I don't have time to really defend it, but my answer is, the short answer is, I don't think that the beast and the false prophet are the same entity as the man of sin. And I am inclined to think that the man of sin could well be the papacy that Paul's talking about there, and that the beast is probably something else, a different concept.
If you're not of the opinion that Satan is a force of evil, but rather a entity, a person, and I'm assuming that's how you believe.
Yes, I believe in a personal devil, definitely.
So if a personal devil is spoken about in that verse, how does that fit neatly with the other two elements of that verse being a system?
What verse are we talking about?
Boy, I wish I had it open to me. But
are you talking about where the beast and the false prophet and the dragon are cast into the lake of fire in Revelation 20?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think it fits because the devil is symbolically depicted as a dragon. And that we have really in chapter 12, the devil is introduced as a dragon with seven heads and ten horns. And then in the next chapter, chapter 13, the dragon has an ally, which comes out of the sea that has seven heads and ten horns. In fact, it appears to be the dragon himself in disguise as a governmental system, an incarnation of Satan in a political entity. And this, you know, the whole visions of Revelation are written as a symbolic kind of a drama. It's not literal. The devil's not literally a dragon. And, you know, the governmental system's not literally an animal with seven heads and ten horns. It's written actually in the language of mythology, but it's actually a true story. It's a true story that's written in the language that you'd find in myths about, you know, dragons and wars in the sky and so forth. And I believe that it's all impressionistic. And when it says that the dragon and the false prophet and the beast are thrown in the lake of fire, I don't have any problem seeing that as saying that all the enemies of the people of God ultimately are thrown into the lake of fire and they are punished, the devil and his allies, which are both the governmental and the religious systems that he animated.
So what do you see in chapter 20, verse 10? Does it not say devil? Your translation says dragon?
It's the devil. It's the devil all the way through. The devil has been called the dragon and the serpent. I mean, like, for example, in Revelation 12:9, it says that the dragon is is that ancient serpent who's called the devil and Satan. So all these terms are used interchangeably for him. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. And by the way, I mean, I don't really have any preference about whether anyone sees it the way I do or not, but that's the way I see it.
Thank you.
All right. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Well, there are other calls I would like to have gotten to. Sadly, the time goes by, and the clock doesn't stop and doesn't forgive. It doesn't give us any breaks, so we're going to have to close it out there. But fortunately, tomorrow is another day, and we have another hour, Lord willing. If the Lord tarries, we'll be able to have another hour together tomorrow. So those of you who didn't get on can call back then, I trust. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and there are no expenses except those that we pay to the radio stations and the phone service that provides the 800 number. There are no staff. There's no overhead. There's no offices. There's no salaries. There's nothing. Just the radio stations. And therefore, any donations that come to the Narrow Path are directly used to make the program stay on the air because we buy the time from the radio stations. So if you're interested in keeping us on the air, we actually do need to have income for that, and you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can also find information about that at the website, which is thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow so that we can continue our discussion. God bless you.